Okay, while we're waiting, let's talk about semen. I told you that it's a mixture of several different things. And sperm are in there, of course. But that's just one of the components. Where do the sperm come from? Well, yeah, they're born, in a sense, in the testes. Through what process? Spermatogenesis, which is what process in itself? Meiosis, right. Those sperm get created in the lumen of the seminiferous tubules, right? And then they mature, as we said, in the epididymis, the tubing of the epididymis. But after all that's done, I mean, that's just a maturation process. Semen really all comes together fairly quickly during orgasm. And so the sperm cells and some fluid from the ductus deferens is the first thing to be added to what eventually will be the semen. What makes the next contribution? As that fluid with the sperm makes it up the ductus deferens into the abdominal pelvic cavity, where does it meet up next? Seminal vesicles, right. The seminal vesicles, actually, their contributions in terms of volume is most of the semen, more than half. 60% or so of the volume of an ejaculate is the secretions of the seminal vesicles on either side. And so they add their bit to the mix. Well, the seminal vesicles produce most of the volume of that is really nutrients. Okay, thank you. It's mostly nutrients. No, it's still hung up. And of those nutrients, most of them are carbohydrates, chiefly fructose. This is going to feed the sperm, basically, in their long swim up the vagina, up into the uterus, into the uterine tubes, where they might encounter an egg. But the seminal vesicle secretions also include they include an unactivated, thank you, that's perfect, an unactivated protein called proseminogelin. Yeah, good.
Have a good class.
Proseminogelin, you know, we've seen this pro prefix before, right? Something gets turned into something else. It needs to be activated by a different protein. And that other protein that activates it is not part of the secretions of the seminal vesicles. Instead, it is one of the members of the secretions of what comes next, which is what? The prostate, yes. Okay, so this proseminogelin, it can get turned into what's called seminogelin, obviously. Seminogelin is very similar to fibrin. And remember, fibrin is not in its active form normally, right? It's fibrinogen, which gets converted into fibrin. For what purpose? Clotting of blood. Well, seminogelin, once it's in its active form from proseminogelin, does a similar thing. It coagulates the semen, makes it very sticky, so that the ejaculated semen will stick to the wall of the vagina and not be washed out. All right, now when it's sticking there, these sperm are trapped, basically. So this can't be a permanent thing if you want the fertilization to take place. and it's not. But we'll talk about that in a second. What I'm saying here is that the proseminogelin itself would cause no clotting. It needs to be converted into seminogelin when it's exposed to a clotting factor, which is the different protein that activates, converts proseminogelin into seminogelin. Well, that clotting factor is one of the components of the prostatic secretions. Okay, so the prostate also adds a fair amount of volume to the overall semen, not quite as much as the seminal vesicles. And the prostate secretions mostly act as a buffer, a chemical buffer. And that's because at lower pH, the sperm are immobile. They can't swim. And the ductwork here, the male tract is acidic, and the vagina is acidic. So in order for them to be able to swim, there needs to be an increase in pH back toward neutrality. And so that's a major job of what the prostate's contribution to semen is. The prostate secretes buffer, calcium ions, citrate, other ions. But the whole thing is also a chemical buffer that increases the pH, all right? Along with that buffering capacity, though, in that mix of things that the prostate produces is the clotting factor that's required to transform the proseminogelin that came from the seminal vesicles into seminogelin. And that's what clots the semen, basically, and sticks it to the wall of the vagina temporarily. The final important part of the prostatic secretions is another protein. And this one is a protease called serine protease, which is also prostate-specific antigen, or PSA. When men get a PSA test to test their, as a medical test for their prostate, that's what it's testing for, the presence of serine protease, or prostate-specific antigen, to determine whether there's any signs of prostatic cancer, for instance. And it's a blood test that tests for something that only the prostate's going to make, which is this serine protease. But the reason that serine protease exists in the semen is to basically undo what the clotting factor did. Remember I said it has to be a temporary sticking of the semen to the vaginal wall because those sperm are stuck there in that sticky mass, unable to continue the swim up the vagina into the cervix, up through the uterus, and so on. So after a half hour or so, then the serine protease that came from the prostate will break down the seminogelin. It's a protease, that means it's an enzyme that breaks down proteins. Well, seminogelin is a protein. It's what makes it like a clot. So when that gets broken down, just like when a blood clot gets broken down, it will liquefy again. And this will free up the sperm. They're not only now no longer held in place, but now because of the buffering capacity of the semen, because of the prostatic secretion, they are able to use their mitochondria and swim with their tails. Okay, so now they're freed up to make the swim up to the uterus and into the uterine tubes. The only other thing I didn't mention that adds a component to semen is what? So we had contribution by the seminal vesicles and the ductus deferens. Basically, that epithelium adds sperm and liquid. Seminal vesicles, prostate gives its contribution, seminal vesicles give their contribution, and then what's the final one? Did you say it? Bulbourethral glands, correct. And the bulbourethral glands, which empty where? Well, into what part of the urethra? The membranous urethra, right. That the shortest part of the urethra. That's all after everything else has added its contribution. What is it that the bulbourethral glands add to the semen? I mentioned it offhandedly last time. Mucus. Mostly mucus. Why is mucus added? Well, why is mucus generally added along tracts? Lubrication, right. So, all of this comes together, and that's the complete semen. One thing that I didn't mention that's actually in the secretions of both the prostate and the seminal vesicles, but more so in the seminal vesicles, are what are called prostaglandins. Now, prostaglandins get named for the fact that they were discovered in prostate glands. That's why it's called prostaglandin. But actually, it's kind of a misnomer because the seminal vesicles produce a lot more prostaglandins than the prostate does. Anyway, prostaglandins are signal molecules. So they operate as signals. And one thing they do is help to break down the mucus that the semen is going to encounter at the cervix, which is the end of the line of the vagina, where it's the opening to the uterus. So there's usually mucus there that would block entry of sperm. That mucus gets broken down with the help of the action of prostaglandins. But prostaglandins also can trigger peristaltic contractions in the vagina and uterus to help the semen along the way, basically, muscularly. Okay, let me see if I can get some pictures now. It'll be easier. Whoops. Now, I think we were just starting to talk about spermatogenesis, right? Meiosis, basically. Isn't that where we were? Which would be probably slide 13. Okay. Well, we see a cartoon of meiosis happening here, and important thing about meiosis, one important thing is that there are two rounds of cell division. But another important thing is that, unlike mitosis, one of these rounds of division reduces the ploidy of the cell. What is ploidy? Not the number of chromosomes. That's too general. The ploidy is how many of each type of chromosome a cell has. And the vast majority, almost all of the cells of your body, have two of each kind of chromosome. There are 23 kinds of chromosomes in a human. But you have two of each of those. They're not identical to each other, but they're the same kind of chromosome. One came from one parent, one from the other parent. Meiosis is going to split those two homologous chromosomes, as they're called, because they're of the same type, apart, so that one of them will be put into one cell and one will be put into another cell. That doesn't happen in mitosis. So that means meiosis reduces the ploidy from diploid, the condition of having two of every kind of chromosome, which we symbolize as 2N. N is the number of kinds. It would be 23 for humans. 2 times N is what the cell is when it's diploid. It reduces that into haploid cells, which are N. But it ends up making 4 cells, because there is, before it even gets to this point, as part of the cell cycle, it goes first through a phase of the cell cycle in which the DNA is replicated. And so when after it's replicated, there's enough actual DNA for 2, which is why if that's all you do in mitosis is double the amount, make a copy of the DNA and then split it into 2, you make 2 identical cells to what the original one was. And those 2 are both diploid. In meiosis, you replicate the DNA, but then you undergo 2 divisions. And so you end up making 4 cells, but they're haploid. And the 2 stages, or the 2 division events are within meiosis are labeled with Roman numerals. So you have meiosis 1 and then meiosis 2. And it's meiosis 1 that actually reduces the ploidy. And that's because of what lines up at the metaphase plate. Metaphase is the stage within meiosis where things line up between the 2 poles of the cell. Well, in meiosis, the things that line up are pairs of chromosomes, not individual chromosomes. They're homologous pairs. So the 2 number 13s line up as a unit. The 2 number 16s line up as a unit, and similarly for all 23 types. Here it's just shown with an N of 2 for simplicity. And so when those then separate, it's not the 2 copies of a chromosome that separate, it's the 1 homolog from one parent and the other homolog from the other parent that separate and go into separate cells. At that moment, you already have haploid cells. At the end of meiosis 1, you already have haploid cells, 2 of them. But because of the copying that happened first, each one of these cells is still a replicated chromosome. That's why there's 2 identical copies hooked together at a centromere. Okay? So there's only 1 of each chromosome type, but each one is actually a duplicate chromosome. So it's enough material for 2 chromosomes once it splits. Meiosis 2 then splits those 2 copies apart. So it's already haploid. The 2 sister chromatids, as they're called, which are exact copies of each other, separate. And that happens for each of the 2 cells, so you end up making 4. They're haploid, they're all genetically different from each other, and they're obviously genetically different from the original cell too, because there's only 1 of each chromosome in them. And during this process, crossing over occurs between homologous chromosomes. So a piece of the maternal version of a chromosome is swapped for the corresponding piece of the paternal version of that same type of chromosome, producing a new combination of DNA that wasn't in either parent. And there's a ridiculously high number of ways that can happen, which is why even though males can produce hundreds of millions of sperm every day, for decades, the chances of producing the same sperm twice genetically in a lifetime is almost 0. Because there's so many ways of just crossing over. But just crossing over, that's only part of it. You also have what's called independent assortment. Now you have a paternal and a maternal version of the chromosome type. And they're going to line up. There's 2 ways they can line up. Maternal and paternal down here, or the other way around, so that they go to different cells. Well, each homologous pair lines up independently of the other ones. So there are 2 raised to the N-1 power ways of that happening, just for independent assortment. So for humans, it would be 2 to the 22nd power, which is something like 8 million ways. So there's 8 million ways just to line up, even if you didn't even have any crossing over. That's a big enough number, but that's 8 million is effectively 0 compared to the number of ways crossing over can occur. And so you take the 8 million and multiply that by the ridiculously high number, and you get an even more ridiculously high number. Meanwhile, the same thing's going on in the female. She has just as many possible eggs that she could produce. And when you produce a zygote for a new child, what you're doing really is drawing one card from that ridiculously huge deck, drawing one card from the female's ridiculously huge deck, and getting them together. So the number of ways that can happen is a ridiculously huge number times a ridiculously huge number. And that's why you don't see the same human occurring twice, no matter how many times you try. It's just inordinately improbable. The only way you have identical twins is if a mistake happens, where it starts out as one zygote, supposed to be one child eventually, but it breaks apart and each one acts as its own zygote. When that happens, they're genetically identical, but it's not going to happen when two eggs are independently fertilized. Those are fraternal twins, right? They're not identical. They don't even have to be the same sex. Okay, let's go to 14 and I'll look at this sperm production as it happens from the bottom of the screen upward. The top of the figure here is the lumen. The seminiferous tubules are where these things are being created, right? So the brownish area at the top is the lumen of a seminiferous tubule. This is the wall of that seminiferous tubule, most of the figure is. Well, it starts down here at this cell labeled 2N and called a type A spermatogonium. Spermatogonia are germline cells. All right, you're made up of two categories of cells. Somatic cells, which means cells of your body. Of course, these other ones are part of your body as well, so it's kind of a misnomer. But somatic cells, which is almost all of the cells in your body, and then a tiny, tiny population of cells found only in your gonads called germline cells. And the male version of germline cells are spermatogonia, which is the plural of spermatogonium. Okay? Now, in terms of ploidy, they're the same. Somatic cells are diploid. They have two of every chromosome, one from each parent. Same is true for spermatogonia, germline cells. They are also diploid. The fundamental difference is that somatic cells undergo only mitosis. If they're going to undergo cell division at all, they're only going to undergo mitosis. Whereas a germline cell, if it's going to undergo division, and it will, it's going to undergo mitosis and meiosis. In that order. Okay, mitosis first. Now, the meiosis, the reason that it's going to go through meiosis, of course, is to produce the actual gametes. So germline cells are not gametes. Gametes are haploid. To get to haploid cells, that diploid germline cell has to undergo meiosis. So that explains why it will undergo meiosis. But why does it undergo mitosis first? Mitosis produces two cells from one, and both of those cells are identical to each other and to the original one. Why would it do that first before entering meiosis? Well, the answer is what I told you a little bit ago. I said that a tiny, tiny population of cells are your germline cells. If the only thing they were to do is to undergo meiosis, then every time that happened, that already tiny population would be depleted by one more cell. You'd have one fewer cell every time a cell underwent meiosis, right? Because the population would be decreasing. Because when a cell divides, the original cell no longer exists. That's why at first, this tiny population of germline cells, they will undergo mitosis. So one cell becomes two. One of those is going to go on to meiosis. The other one replaces the one that no longer exists. So the population stays the same of the germline cells. And that's why this book is calling the type that hangs around and replaces the one that's no longer there a type A spermatogonium. And so it's just going to undergo mitosis again. become two cells, one of which will be a type A again, the other of which will be a type B. The type B, though, then migrate through this wall, and notice that they're 2N, they're diploid, and that's because mitosis does not change the ploidy. So the type B spermatogonium is still diploid, but when it undergoes meiosis, then it's going to no longer be diploid. It's going to turn it into haploid cells. Well, the primary spermatocyte that is labeled here, that simply is a later stage of that same type B spermatogonium. Okay? So as part of its cell cycle development, it eventually becomes a primary spermatocyte. That is the cell that actually then enters meiosis. Meiosis 1 is the first division, and remember I said that that's the one that reduces the ploidy. So the two cells that are produced by meiosis 1 are already haploid, which is why they're labeled N. And in terms of sperm production, these are called secondary spermatocytes. Okay, so a primary spermatocyte enters meiosis 1. Two secondary spermatocytes come out of meiosis 1 and enter meiosis 2. Meiosis 2 doesn't change the ploidy because meiosis 2 is really just like mitosis. All it does is separate those duplicates, those sister chromatids that I was talking about. But that's happening for each of the two secondary spermatocytes, so you end up with four spermatids or spermatids, which are not yet fully mature sperm. For one thing, notice they don't even have a tail yet, but it's genetically they are done. Okay? Meiosis is about getting the genetics right. So these spermatids or spermatids are already haploid. They have just the right amount of DNA. They don't have two copies of it, and they're also haploid. And they then begin their 3-week-long maturation process that I was talking about. But notice that they grow tails as part of their development that are facing the lumen of the seminiferous tubules, and then they just gradually detach their heads from the wall of the tubule as more and more get created and as fluid gets secreted as well. Now, they're not swimming away. They just get flushed away because they're inactive swimmers at this point. Why are they inactive swimmers? Not only because they haven't yet fully matured, but for whatever reason. Well, yeah, that would be an intentional reason why. Yeah, they don't want to actually waste their energy, but also they're inactivated because of the low pH that I was talking about, right? So not until ejaculation will they have, until after ejaculation will the pH come up closer to neutral enough for them to swim on their own. All right, now let's go to 15 and look at these sperm as they mature. It's not just about growing a tail. I mean, that's definitely an important part of it. But notice that right where the tail meets the head of the sperm is a complex of mitochondria. So compared to most cells, sperm have huge and many mitochondria. And this is what, I mean, this shouldn't be surprising for something that has a very, very long swim ahead. Now, it's long from the viewpoint of the sperm, right? If you think about it in terms of body lengths, it's a very long swim that they have to do all the way up the vagina into the uterus and into uterine tubes. So that requires a lot of energy, which is why the mitochondria are there, right? Mitochondria are the organelles of cellular respiration. So they produce a lot of ATP as long as there's fuel available. And where does the fuel come from? The fructose and the other carbohydrates that are in the semen that I was talking about. Okay, the acrosome, by the way, that you see here, that is a kind of a shell-like covering of the head that becomes important if this sperm is lucky enough to get to an egg. But we'll just leave it at that for now. In 16, we're just looking at a mature sperm here, so this one is ready to go. It's already been spent 3 weeks or so in the epididymis, and remember, at the end of the epididymis, which is the beginning of the ductus deferens, sperm get temporarily stored there until ejaculation occurs. If it doesn't, remember, then they're just dismantled and reused for raw materials. But this one is ready to go. Still not going to swim, though, because of the pH. But notice that this, even though it looks big on this picture, this is a very small cell. It's really just about as small as it can be and as mobile as it can be, which is perfect for a male gamete, right? Remember, the female gamete needs to be big and stay put. It needs to stay put because it's so big, but it needs to be big so that it can have as much cytoplasm as possible for the zygote that it will become if a sperm injects its DNA. So the sperm is just a package as small as it can be of DNA in the head of the sperm that gets injected into the egg at fertilization, if that happens. And if that does happen, we no longer call it an egg at that point. We call it a zygote. And an egg is haploid. The sperm is haploid. When you get two haploid genomes or sets of chromosomes together, you have once again a diploid cell. So the zygote is diploid, the egg that it came from is haploid, and the sperm is haploid. Okay, now to 17. Here we're looking at steps of orgasm. So before orgasm, there is the excitement phase, as you see here, and we can see that the neural wiring that is influential in this. So visual, mental, and other stimuli, stuff happening in the brain basically, is going to cause erection, but it's the erection is caused, as I've talked about earlier, by the fact that blood is easily allowed into the columns of the penis. What are those columns? There are two corpora cavernosa and a corpus spongiosum, right? Those get engorged with blood not only because there's a widening of the vessels allowing more blood in, but because when that blood expands those columns, it presses on the outlet veins. So you're bringing more blood in than can leave, and therefore the hydrostatic pressure builds up. So that's the actual physical reason for erection. Notice also that the bulbo urethral glands begin secreting mucus as a lubricant, because ejaculation is probably going to occur. That's the thinking here. Actual orgasm occurs in stages. First is the emission stage. Emission refers to creating the semen by bringing all of the components together, basically. So peristaltic contraction of the walls of the ductus deferens brings the testes contribution, testes and epididymis contribution to the semen up the ductus deferens into the very end, the enlargement that you see at the end of the ductus deferens after it, when it's just about to dump into the prostate. That's called the ampulla. And so notice that it says that the sperm are moved into the ampulla because of this peristaltic contraction. So nothing has come out of the urethra yet. Emission just means bringing it to the urethra. But the other major contributors here, the prostate and the seminal vesicles, secrete their components. And so semen is now in the urethra, ready for the expulsion stage. And it's not like this is a big drawn-out thing. Emission and expulsion happen one after another, but they are distinct things are happening here, which is why they're named different things. And so that because of muscular contraction, there's actual forcible expulsion of the semen from the penis, and assuming that penis happens to be in a vagina, that means that's where the ejaculate will be. And thanks to the interaction between the clotting factor and the proseminogelin, that ejaculate is going to stay put, like I said, for about a half hour in the wall of the vagina, so it doesn't get wasted. And then the serine protease from the prostate will break down that seminogelin, free up the sperm, which because of the increased pH will now be able to swim up the vagina. But meanwhile, in the man, the last stage down here is resolution, which is basically bringing things back to normal. There, in a male, there is a period in which an additional orgasm becomes impossible. Males don't undergo multiple orgasms, in other words. One orgasm, then there needs to be a resting period, and then it can happen again, of course, unlike in a female. In 18, which might be the last figure, it is. In 18, we're looking at chemicals involved in the erection process. And so notice that nitric oxide, which is a gas, is operating as a signal here. Nitric oxide allows for the conversion of an inactive form of an enzyme called guanylate cyclase into its active form. All right, well, nitric oxide is not present in great concentrations until sexual stimulation. So as a result of that, inactive guanylate cyclase is activated, and when it's activated, of course, it does its job as an enzyme. In this case, that enzyme's job is to transform GTP, which is what kind of thing? Well, it can be used for energy, but what is it structurally speaking? It's the same kind of thing as ATP is, which is what? It's a nucleoside triphosphate, exactly. Or it could also be called a nucleotide, because a nucleoside with at least one phosphate on it is a nucleotide. More specifically, though, yeah, you're right, it's a nucleoside triphosphate. So it's just like ATP, only using guanine instead of adenine. Anyway, GTP gets converted by this guanylate cyclase enzyme into cyclic GMP. Very similar to cyclic AMP, which itself is a signal that's used in many cells, as we've been talking about in cell bio. Well, cyclic GMP doesn't exist in that form forever, but while it's in that form, this is what actually leads to the vasodilation of the arteries bringing blood to the penis. So this is why there's engorgement originally of those erectile tissues, the two corpora cavernosa and the corpus spongiosum. Like I said, that's a temporary thing. Cyclic GMP is eventually then just the ring which makes it cyclic is broken, so it's just ordinary GMP at that point, no longer doing its job. And therefore, blood flow is reduced to the penis, and as a little bit leaks through the veins without more coming in, then eventually the veins aren't pressed on nearly as much, and the whole penis can drain normally, and that's when it becomes flaccid again. Well, the loss of erection here is the result of GMP, cyclic GMP, no longer being around. And so it's a phosphodiesterase enzyme. Phosphodiesterase is an enzyme that will break the little the second link that the phosphate makes with guanosine to make it cyclic GMP. So that's what will inactivate cyclic GMP, which will lead to loss of an erection. Well, phosphodiesterase inhibitors are not things you make in your own body. These are drugs, right? Exogenous drugs. That's kind of redundant. A drug is exogenous, something that you put into your body. This is one way of handling erectile dysfunction, right? If you disable the phosphodiesterases, which your body does make, if you inhibit those enzymes, then they don't break down cyclic GMP, allowing it to hang around longer, which will maintain the erection. This would be for someone who abnormally breaks down cyclic GMP, which is why he would have the inability to remain erect. So the phosphodiesterase inhibitor is a drug. The phosphodiesterase is the natural enzyme that the drug operates on in order to keep the penis erect.
Okay, we finished in time.